group meeting, Sunday, 11th May, 1986. At first sight, the gates are barred. Sri Rama says to Hanuman in the Muktikopanishad, never should the Upanishads be imparted to an atheist, an ungrateful person, one intent on vicious actions, one having no devotion to me, or one who loses his way in the cave of books. It's a wonderful teaching. One who loses his way in the cave of books. One wonders why that injunction is given. Going through the cave of books, one acquires a great deal of knowledge. But the acquisition of knowledge does not mean that that person's innermost consciousness has changed or has realized the truth. The affirmations are the affirmations of the supreme truth as such, which man, constituted as he is up to the present date, can possibly know about, you see. But if a person is lost in the cave of books, he cannot realize transcendent truth. Wisdom is different from learning. Learning, knowledge in the worldly sense of the word knowledge, however brilliant and marvelous, is often a hindrance to this fulfillment of the human being in spiritual terms. The sage Svetashvatara says, this highest mystery in the Vedanta, which has been declared in a former age, should not be given to one whose passions are not subdued, nor again to one who is not a son or a pupil. As you all know, I constantly quarrel with the old formulations. I don't like the wording, the way they put it. Now here is a case in point. Whose passions are not subdued. This is a slightly mistaken psychology. What is a passion? What is anything that happens in terms of one's thought and feeling and also action? It is an expression of one's own psychophysical energy. If you want to subdue any part of it, it means that you are in conflict with it. And it is this state of conflict which shuts the gates of heaven. There must be no conflict. You don't subdue what we call evil or overcome it. You don't fight against it. You understand it. And with your understanding, you are able to transform that energy. Otherwise, you are destroying your own energy. Soon you'll be dead and that's that. There'll be a funeral and nothing else. Subdued. Nor again to one who is not a son or a pupil. We all know what a pupil means. But the word son in the religious context does not mean, perhaps not always in all cases, but in most cases, it does not mean a son of the flesh. The disciple, the pupil, who had come to that stage where he had the greatest understanding of what the teacher had taught, and had himself realized truth inwardly, and who would, therefore, when the teacher died, be the successor of that teacher. He would step into his shoes, you see. He was called son. Ye are the sons of my mouth, O bhikkhus, said the Buddha. In the Rig Veda, the 10th book, hymn 90, I think, the Brahman is called the son of Brahma's mouth. The son of his mouth. One of the Upanishads, the Vajrasuchi Upanishad, explains very clearly what is meant by a Brahman. He is not one who merely belongs to the Brahman caste. He may be anybody whatsoever. This is distinctly stated in the Vajrasuchi Upanishad. He may belong to any caste by birth, but if he has realized Brahman, then he is rightly called a Brahman. You see, Brahman and Brahman. From somebody's name, the name of someone or something happens to be the source from which you are derived, then the A sound becomes an A sound in Sanskrit. You see? The Upanishads should be taught only to a son. And you might say, that's very strange. He's called a son, and then he already knows a great deal about these things. What is there to teach him? One may know the words and not have realized the actuality in consciousness. You know that very famous chapter, I think it's the last chapter in the Chandogya Upanishad, where he goes, the seeker after truth goes to Sanat Kumar, Narada is the one, he goes to Sanat Kumara and says, demonstrate or teach me Brahman. And Sanat Kumara says, tell me what you already know. And it turns out from the recital he gives Narada is an encyclopedia of all the knowledge available in his day. But, says Narada, I am as one who only knows the words, but I do not know the Atma, meaning the essence of these things, which would be in terms of conscious realization. And so Sanat Kumara then teaches him the way for the conscious realization. And I've said this over and over again in our meetings. To consciously realize something is quite different from having an idea about it. The ordinary sort of knowledge. You may believe something, you may have a thought about something, but that belief on the whole is pretty impotent. It can't make you live the holy life in the profound sense and have the powers, the great healing powers and so on, associated with conscious realization. When you consciously realize something, then quite naturally and spontaneously and always, that something will easily express itself in all your thought and feeling, your speech and your action. So when a person says, oh yes, I know this, I know that, be very careful. You know how often I've said, what I really know is that I know nothing. And I was delighted some 3 weeks ago to see in a magazine which came from India, the writer of the article quoting Socrates. Socrates said, "All I know is that I do not know." And I've been saying it for some years myself, so I'm glad to be in Socrates' company. The seer Shakayanya says to King Brihadratha, "Let no one declare this most secret doctrine to anyone who is not a son, who is not a pupil, who is not of a tranquil mind." Now, what is a tranquil mind? Not just a person who has a very quiet demeanor. It's not just that. It's not just that kind of tranquility. Who is not easily upset, whose emotions, whose thoughts are not in turmoil and so forth. It is all that plus something very much profounder. The tranquil mind is one where the brain has stopped chattering. We may feel very quiet and happy and peaceful and so forth. And we may say, "Oh, isn't this wonderful?" and so on. But in saying this is wonderful, you have destroyed the tranquility of that mind. You see, this is something extremely difficult. Just as the practice of yoga is extremely difficult. Everybody here, certainly in the West anyway, and I dare say nowadays good men in India too, yoga to them means all sorts of physical contortions and keeping fit. It's another keeping fit system. That is the least part of it. The yamas, the niyamas, the various virtues, the various modes of practicing the religious life, then the pratyahara, the freedom from attachment and aversion, the entry into dharana, the upholding of the law of the universe, the law of karma, the law of creative action all the way through, and dhyana, which is meditation, and entering the meditative state in which finally the brain has stopped talking. There is absolute silence. In that silence, you really meditate. It is a little bit like this. An infant is born. All right. The parents do the needful for helping that infant to continue to live. They do everything possible. But that infant lives by virtue of life, not by what is done for it. So similarly, when we have so lived, are so capable of getting the brain to stop chattering, then for the first time we enter into the meditative state. And in that meditative state, there is no musing, there is no thinking, there are no brilliant ideas, no beliefs, convictions come into being. It is an extraordinary state. This creative action in eternity is something indescribable. But you, any one of us, anybody in the world, can sometimes just get that stroke of lightning of transcendence, as I call it so often, just that flash of eternity which suddenly enlightens you, just for an infinitesimal fraction of a second, but that's enough. It makes such an impression on the whole psychophysical organism that you know for the rest of your life, unless some accident or something happens to destroy your brain in some way or other, you, for the rest of your life, it is there. You know that is so. This is really so. So, the tranquil mind, when that state comes into being, our own psyche is utterly pure. And, being utterly pure, it offers no obstruction to the light of transcendence, which affects you, the individual, here and now, alive in this world, in such a manner that sooner or later thoughts will arise, ideas will come, thoughts and ideas which are insights into the profoundest reality which human beings can possibly look into. You see, we are always limited by our constitution. We are psychophysical animals. You see, we can do this, that and the other, which no other species of the animal kingdom can do. That is true. But at the same time, we have our limits. And the proof of that, you look at the scriptural writings throughout the millennia, and every one of them has some flaws here and there. I have already pointed out one or two flaws in these writings, you see. Those flaws begin to disappear with the increasing knowledge of the nature of things and of people. The nature of things, knowledge of the nature of things means science and mathematics and all that sort of thing, you see. And knowledge of the nature of people means psychology, true penetrative psychology. Not this superficial psychology which has come into being particularly during the last two or three centuries, you see. Not just that, much more than that, much profounder than that. When the knowledge of the nature of things and of the nature of human beings undergoes a critical change, then your whole ontology and the consequent theology undergoes a transformation. This has happened historically. One of the finest examples is the changeover from the Platonic Augustinian Catholic theology to the Aristotelian Thomistic theology. There was a gap of 8 centuries between them, between St. Augustine and St. Thomas Aquinas. It's one of the finest examples of this. There have been many other examples, but I don't know all of them. So, we'll go on. Sri Krishna says, Sri Krishna says to Arjuna, never is this to be spoken by thee to anyone who is without austerity, nor to one without devotion, nor to one who desireth not to listen. That's very important. Nor yet to him who speaketh ill of me. Not to be spoken to anyone without austerity. Now, don't let us misunderstand the use of the word austerity there. Centuries ago, in the time of the Buddha, for instance, and as a matter of fact, throughout so many centuries in India, people, these yogis, practicing the most horrible, idiotic, body and soul destroying austerities in order to achieve some wonderful occult powers and all the rest of that rubbish. You see, nothing of the sort. The Buddha practiced austerities, second to none in the world. There are 2 or 3 discourses in which he describes them in full, and they really are horrible. those austerities. All that happened with the practice of the austerities was that it brought him to the verge of death. And he saw, this is no good. So he put it aside. You see. What is right austerity? Refraining from anything and everything which is unnecessary for healthy psychophysical existence and for the development of your perceptive powers into reality. Whatsoever is unnecessary, you refrain from it. So, if one understands that and tries to live in accordance with that, then all the flaws in our character, in our nature, and in the body itself, they will just drop off naturally. Our word asceticism and ascetic, those words are derived from the Greek ascesis. And ascesis literally means sloughing off that which is unnecessary. That is all. Let it go away. It's unnecessary. But you are the person yourself who has to see that it is unnecessary. Don't go to a teacher, a psychiatrist or somebody, or autophilosmator, to tell you what you should do. Don't take it from anybody else. If you take it from somebody else, it will remain as a thought, as an idea in your mind. And if it is something which prevents you from carrying on with something which is very pleasant and happy for you, you will undergo awful conflict and you'll just be sick, body and soul. You must see for yourself. What you see for yourself, supposing I see for myself that object in this room is really unnecessary, it's an ugly old piece or something, then when I have seen it for myself, I'll get rid of it. But if somebody tells me, Firoz, why do you have that wretched thing there? Throw it away. Then when he's gone, I'll say, really, that fellow, fancy telling me that. You see, it's like that. You must see for yourself. Just as we have physical eyes. Nobody can teach you to see. You've got your eyes, you see. You've got your ears, you hear. You've got your tongue, you taste. You've got your nose, you smell, and so forth. You've got life energy, and you just live by virtue of life, not by any virtue of anything else. Similarly, where insight, where enlightenment is concerned, you see for yourself with the eyes of what? Of your own self. When the brain is quiet, then mind comes into play. I was very glad to see in that bulletin of Krishna, about Krishnamurti, in that last talk, he says the mind is different from the brain. And he said the mind can communicate with the brain, but the brain cannot communicate with the mind. All our thinking is inaudible talking. That inaudible talking could just be, can be, just managed to be through the purification of the psyche, the instrument for expressing what the mind has communicated to the brain. Now you'll ask, what do you mean by the mind? Mind is a universal archetypal form of the primordial creative energy whose function is a formative function. The release of a universe, of a cosmos. The Greek word cosmos is very good here. It means order. the release, the bringing into being, the bringing forth of an orderly universe. So you see, cosmos comes into being through the activity of the primordial creative energy in that particular archetypal form which we call mind. The hint of this is in the Vishuddhi Magga. There is a hint there. Years, I came across it in the 1950s, and I worked on it and worked on it, and then suddenly one day it happened, and there it was, you see. So then mind functions, and that is also the tranquil mind. So austerity goes, all the fixed austerities and what you are compelled to do because the teacher has said it or the guru has said it. You know one of the meanings of the word guru? The heavy-handed one. The one who bangs you right and left. Yes, that's one of its meanings. No wonder Krishnaji was allergic to all gurus. So, away with austerities, without devotion. How shall we understand emotion? Devotion. Perhaps it is selfless love which naturally and spontaneously cannot help giving itself to the object of devotion. So that all one's life is a life which expresses in thought and word and deed that love. It demands nothing for itself. If there's any demand for oneself, it has ceased to be devotion. It has ceased to be love too. Now, Jesus says in his Sermon on the Mount, and of all the founders of religions, Jesus didn't refrain from strong language when necessary. Give not that which is holy unto the dogs, neither cast ye your pearls before swine, lest they trample them under their feet and turn again and rend you. How true. Dionysius, the Areopagite, this is not this is the pseudo-Dionysius, not the Areopagite who was, not the Dionysius who was one of the followers of Jesus in his lifetime. Not that Dionysius. This Dionysius, the Areopagite, was probably, as far as scholars can make out, a Syrian monk who lived in the 6th century. But he assumed the pseudonym of Dionysius the Areopagite. And I pray, let no uninitiated person approach the sight, S-I-G-H-T, sight, for neither is it without danger to gaze upon the glorious rays of the sun with weak eyes, nor is it without peril to put our hands to things above us. And this comes from his work on the ecclesiastical hierarchy, and another one that is called The Mystical Theology. I have both those books. They are really marvelous little treatises. and they need very, very careful study to begin to understand what he's talking about. But they really are wonderful. These things thou must not disclose to any of the uninitiated, by whom I mean those who cling to the objects of human thought and imagine there is no superessential reality beyond, and fancy that they know by human understanding him that has made darkness his secret place. The uninitiated are those who cling to the objects of human thought. The word thought here includes, of course, desire, human desire, you see. That is the ordinary desires which are the consequence of our animal evolution. And so on. And imagine there is no super essential reality. This man who wrote under the name, this Syrian monk, uses the term super essential over and over again throughout his writings. And they fancy that they know by human understanding, that is just by using the brain, him that has made darkness his secret place. You know how in the Kabbalistic teachings, Ein Sof, the primordial origin of everything, out of Ein Sof, which is hidden, which is dark, there emerges the mystical nothing. But not nothing in the sense in which we ordinarily use the word in everyday discourse. There emerges the mystical no-thing. What is that no-thing? The only way to understand it that I can present at the moment is just this. What is a thing? That which has come into manifestation. And whatsoever has come into manifestation is born, it will go through its lifespan, it will die. It belongs to the realm of mortality, of death. But the no thing is that which is pure origin. If one may use Buddhist language, the void which is the source of the plenitude. That is the no thing, the nothing. This idea of nothingness comes into Christian mysticism right the way from the beginning. You know, the earliest great mystics of Christendom were St. Paul and St. John. They were the great mystics. And I wouldn't be surprised in those days if they had some sort of acquaintance and knowledge of Indian and maybe even Chinese teachings. You see, there was Philo Judaeus, as he was called, before the days of Jesus. He lived before the days of Jesus. Philo Judaeus, who had very profound knowledge of things esoteric. And that teaching spread, especially through Alexandria and so forth, which may have Paul He was Saul, remember, of Tarsus. Saul of Tarsus may have come across all that teaching. I don't know. Then, from the supreme path, the rosary of precious gems of the Tibetan master Gampopa of the Kagyupta sect. He produced quite a lot, but this is one of those things, The Ten Causes of Regret. And these are numbers 7 and 8 of those 10 causes of regret. The perfect wisdom, having been found within oneself in virtue of the teacher's grace, it would be a cause of regret to dissipate it amidst the jungle of worldliness. To sell like so much merchandise the sublime doctrine of the sages would be a cause of regret. What a lot of buying and selling goes on in the name of religion. You remember Jesus, you know the statement in the Bible, Jesus overturning the money changers' tables. You can't barter with truth, with God, with transcendence. If you do, and you know a good deal goes on today all over the world, if you do, there will always come some calamity, some disaster upon the doer and upon others who are associated with the doer. Now I go on. Supreme teachers laid down the injunction. The heart of religion was to be withheld from the vicious, the ungrateful, the unsubdued, from those without devotion, austerity, tranquility, from dogs and swine, from those who were not sons or pupils, from the curious, and from both the lettered and the unlettered. I fully appreciate this statement, from the curious. That was my own living experience in my very young days. I suffered from the most awful greed for knowledge. I wanted to know all about everything. A proper greedy dog or swine, you see. And it took me practically half my life before I discovered how absurd and stupid that was and how wrong it was. There we are. Intellectual greed characterized me far more than any physical greed. I had practically no physical greed, food and that sort of thing is concerned. So listen to the old man, children. Who then were those worthy to receive the teaching? Sri Rama says to Hanuman, O Maruti, that is one of the names by which Hanuman is known, it is only after thorough testing that the Upanishads should be imparted to a disciple giving service to the teacher, to a well-disposed son, or to one devoted to me, following good observances, belonging to a good family, and being of good intelligence. It's very interesting, this good family idea, which comes right through the Vedic teachings and writings. It doesn't mean good family in our modern sense of the word, all over the world. It doesn't mean that I'm the Duke of, what shall we say, Jericho's son, you see. It doesn't mean that. Good family was one which lived according to the Vedic teachings. That was the essential meaning of good family. And the various religious observances, which included so many social observances, which today we have introduced into the world in terms of the welfare state, you see. It was the duty of the middle generation, the grandparents, the middle generation, and the little ones, the new who are coming. One had duties to each and every one of them, and one had to live by that, and that was living, belonging to a good family. Whoever studies or hears the 108 Upanishads attains... Oh, I got to the wrong place. Sorry. No, that's right. To one who is devoted to none other than his teacher, to one endowed with all good qualities, one may give it. Out of compassion, the truth is withheld, because the truth always sears, it burns us. It sears all, but whereas the searing moves the unfit to evil and to spreading destruction, it purifies and heals the worthy one. Out of reverence and love for the truth, it is withheld, for truth is a tender flower. How easily its beauty is shattered when the organizer congeals it into an inflexible, rigid doctrine. How easily its fragrance is lost in the incense of the rituals and the smoke of the crude fantasies of the conventionally pious. The scripture is twofold, exoteric and esoteric. The exoteric is the outward teaching of the priest, the external observances and beliefs of the populace. Based on the exoteric arise the palaces of theological thought, the petrified illusion of truth, authoritatively asserted and automatically accepted by the senseless, that is, by those who, seeing, are not... seeing, see not, hearing, hear not. You know, this seeing, see not, hearing, hear not, was first pronounced by Zarathustra. 200 or 300 years ago. In his gathas, he talks of them, the Kavis and the Karapans, and so forth. The exoteric is a vast prison, for have we not offended God, scandalized truth? Must we not then serve our sentence? It happens, however, that the inhabitant of this prison is himself the trinity of judge, prisoner, and jailer. We do it all ourselves. We bring it on ourselves. The prisoner could become free by virtue of the esoteric. No power can prevent him. It is he himself who prevents himself, because he cannot, in his present condition, understand the esoteric and apply it. Unwisely clinging to the destitution of greed, he covets the riches of freedom. Meek poverty is the riches of freedom. But on this he casts a harsh eye. So he seeks a teacher who will show him the way to break out of his prison quickly and violently, but yet allow him to wallow in his present condition. In other words, this deluded, greedy one wants to grab the best of both worlds. The inexorable law of life leads him to a self-professing teacher. Beware of the self-professing teacher. Lewd-lipped, selling the way out. Round such teachers grow petty cults. The teacher fattens, and teacher and pupil move deathwards. The indignant retort is, "But I did get such and such desirable results." Let us always remember, get and desirable results are absent from the fullness of truth. All worldly criteria are invalid where the truth of religion is concerned. So, the true teachers lay down certain prerequisites, devotion, being endowed with good qualities of good intelligence. The pupil has to discover the meaning and content of these qualifications. He has to learn to grow in virtue, soul strength. That's one of my definitions of virtue. Soul strength. Latin vir is a man, and virtus is that which is excellent in man. What is excellent in man but his psyche? That's why I put soul strength. By freeing himself from the lustful acquisition of virtue. You practice virtue in order to be the favored one of God, of the teacher, and so forth. It's a lust. Lust bars out intelligence, defeats insight, and so the esoteric teaching remains a closed book to a man because of his own incapacity to look or to listen, however much he may read the word of the mystic doctrine, or study the instructions of the great teachers, or practice the techniques of yoga. We have to change our condition radically. This change has nothing to do with the existing order of society outside ourselves. It has everything to do with the existing disorder in our own minds and hearts. By virtue of such a change, we can understand esoteric teaching.